You know, I hear, you know, this, my sense of the region is that, you know, we're dealing with a region that for so long was defined by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and perhaps one other conflict going on in the margins, the Lebanese Civil War, for instance, the Iran-Iraq War. Now we're dealing with, I mean, we're dealing with not only the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but Lebanon in almost an undeclared civil war, Iraq in just utter chaos. Just the level of degradation in the region is so breathtaking to me, and so it's hard, and it's hard for me, I guess, to see something really happening on the Israeli-Palestinian front that's not undertaken for cynical purposes. And I think there is a certain cynicism that colors what's going on in these Israeli-Palestinian talks. Now, people who are informed better than me think that I'm wrong. I mean, some people that I've talked to are actually hopeful about what's afoot right now. But, you know, I think what we're seeing here in action is what the Israelis and the Americans are trying to do time and again, and that's to disenfranchise a very powerful current in the politics of these countries, and that's the Islamist current. And it's got to be, it's a current that's got to be represented. It's a current that is essential if we're going to have any kind of democratic transformation in countries like Egypt, Lebanon, or Palestine, Jordan, for that matter. And it's a current that, until now, the Israelis and the Americans simply won't, not embrace, I mean, nobody's asking them to embrace it, but even acknowledge. And
so the Rice's Peace Conference and the countries that are invited and the countries that aren't invited are indicative of a kind of a lining up of pro-American forces arrayed against Islamist forces. I mean, is this sort of what you're sketching out?
I think that's
out?
Right. I think that at one level, and I think at another level, this is where we talk about this kind of cynical notion of sectarian tensions. Is that, you know, the way that the Bush administration, that Rice used kind of fomenting Sunni anxiety over Shiite Iran to, like, you know, further this. This campaign against Iran. I mean, very cynical, cynical playing with tensions that, you know, that worked to some degree. I mean, it did work to some degree, and I think, but the long-term impact of it is disastrous. You know, I'll never forget, it's funny, because being in downtown in Solidaire, you know, it was basically the kind of the symbol of Rafiq Hariri's tenure in Lebanon, the rebuilding of the downtown, and being there when Hezbollah started the sit-in and started it in downtown Beirut. You know, I think people overstated the degree of that, this, you know, of what they represented. But there was no quite, you couldn't escape the notion that the people that had long been disenfranchised in Lebanese politics, the people that had been on the margins, the people that had been left out of even Hariri's vision, I think to a certain degree, had all of a sudden come and seized the downtown, and making a political statement of it. It was very symbolic, I think, and it was inescapable. And I think both the people who were in the downtown understood it, and people who were watching it happen in the rest of Lebanon saw it happen as well. There is a notion of that. And I think, you know, in just understanding Lebanese politics, which are a world unto themselves, it's hard, to me at least, it's hard to escape the notion that what we're seeing is a very long-standing arc of Shiite empowerment take place in Lebanon, something that's happened, that dates back to the late 60s and is playing itself out now in a very forceful way. And that, and again, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that you can't, you know, you've got to understand Hezbollah's relationship to the Shiite community, an organic relationship, and what that represents and what it means for the future of Lebanese politics. You know, Lebanon, I think, has always been interesting because it kind of outpunches its weight. It's always kind of said a little bit more than it, you know, than it maybe would be able to say, just being 4 million people. But I think it's outpunched its weight because it, in some ways, it fits into the grander scheme of things going on in the region in such a concise way. You know, everybody's playing their proxy battle out in Lebanon. Not to absolve Lebanese responsibility for any of the conflicts that happened, but, you know, the opposite. But I think also these conflicts that go on in Lebanon in some ways mirror the conflicts that are going on in the rest of the region, between Iran and the United States, for instance, between, you know, the visions of the region, you know, economically, socially, politically. I mean, I think that that Lebanon is often a very powerful microcosm of what's afoot elsewhere.
So this sort of neoliberal rebuilt paradise that's downtown Beirut. Uh-huh. I mean, how comfortable was that place for people from the south, for people from these villages? I mean, is there a perception that this was built, because Lebanon is deeply indebted. The expense of rebuilding the downtown in this sort of very beautiful but also very, very posh fashion, mm-hmm, was tremendously expensive. Mm-hmm. And it indebted everyone on some level. But I mean, how widely is the feeling, held that that was done for everyone? I mean, are people from the South comfortable there?
I think that's a great, I think that's a great question. And I think that's what you really see, especially, let me just speak anecdotally again, but I'll never forget this. I was walking through the downtown area after Hezbollah had started the sit-in protest with some young guys from the Dahya, the area of South Beirut that's the poorest area of South Beirut, and it's populated largely by immigrants from the Shiite countryside. And I'll never forget us walking by this one building, and the lights were still on. I think it was 2 a.m, and the lights were still on. And they just marveled at this fact. Can you believe it? And they, not in a positive way, but they looked at it. Can you believe the lights are still on at 2 a.m., and we don't have electricity in the Dahya for 6-8 hours a day? And I think it was a real, to them, it was a real a notion of, you know, a real, what's the word I'm looking for? It represented the disparity of resources, yeah. The disparity of existences in some ways. And, you know, the downtown was not for the Shia to a large degree. It wasn't for the working class Christians that are represented by Michelle Aoun in this alliance with Hezbollah either. And I think there's a lot of this, the sit-in that was very political in some ways also funneled a very, you know, deep disenchantment with the direction of Solidaire, for instance, of what the downtown represented, of making Lebanon, you know, putting Lebanon in the service of broader forces of capital that, you know, not everyone was going to share in.
So the sit-in was right there in the center of town, all of these places that had been, where these people had previously been sort of, actively excluded from.
Yeah, actively excluded, and, you know, and they didn't feel comfortable being there. There's no question about it. Now they were there, and it did, I think it made, you know, I think when people look back on this conflict in 20, 30 years, I think that's going to be one of the statements it really made. It's going to be one of the statements that people remember, what that, you know, how the sit-in represented that. This not reclamation, but this laying claim to an area that wasn't theirs before.
And how do, I mean, from the perspective of Lebanese who do feel comfortable in these posh new areas and who feel that this was made for them, by them, I mean, how did they react to the presence of these unwashed masses from the countryside?
You know, I think you hear a lot of people in Lebanon these days when they're trying to make this critique of Hezbollah. They'll say, well, you know, this notion of the Shiites being disenfranchised or the Shiites not being part of Lebanese politics, it's overstated. That this was maybe the case 50 or 60 years ago, but it's just not the case anymore. You often hear this criticism, and I think it's a way of taking away, you know, legitimacy from Hezbollah to make that argument. But I think what we saw, especially just like this, what you're pointing out, the rest of Lebanese seeing what was happening, not all Lebanese, but other Lebanese seeing what was happening when the sit-in protest began, I think it showed the uglier side to Lebanese sentiments. There is still a deep current of anti-Shiite chauvinism that runs through the Lebanese body politic. It's still there. It's often very forcefully stated. It's definitely whispered constantly, and I think this is part of what, you know, Hezbollah and the Shiites are, you know, reacting against, that the country eventually is going to be a Shiite country, and it is now or it's later, but it's going to happen, that Lebanese politics need to be reconfigured.
And those people realize that the economic system, the political system, is not set up for their benefit as it is today.
That's exactly right. You know, a new deal has to be brokered, basically. And, yeah. You know, I think one person said it to me this way, that Hezbollah or the Shia haven't said exactly what they want, and the rest of Lebanon hasn't said what they're willing to give. And that's where we're at right now. We're at that.
So the sit-in is still going on. The parliament's supposed to elect the president. That hasn't happened.
Right.
And there's a lot of speculation, I think, and we talked about this, that the impediment to a deal that will create a new government, elect the president within the parliament, is coming from outside. What are people talking about? I mean, what's the stumbling block to stabilizing the Lebanese political system, at least in the near term?
It's, you know, it's almost the definition of the word process. There's continually talks going on between, you know, among Lebanese politicians, among the, you know, the Maronite Patriarch, for instance, and other leaders in Lebanon. You know, this process is at work almost in a kind of a ferocious pace. But I think at the same time, most Lebanese realize that there will be no deal without a deal abroad. In other words, as long as the U.S.-Iranian standoff continues, as long as the United States and Syria remain on different pages, there's going to be no resolution to the crisis in Lebanon. I think there's a sense among a lot of Lebanese at this point that the Americans themselves are being maximalist in terms of trying to stop a compromise. And it's not that, you know, at first glance it maybe sounds a little bit conspiratorial, but when you think about it, it actually makes sense, given what American politics are today, to have a compromise, you have to bring Hezbollah into the government. You have to recognize Hezbollah's role in Lebanese politics. You have to cede some power to the Shiite community. None of these things are on the agenda for the Americans right now. And as American politics are, as American policy is constituted right now, opposing those things is what they've been doing for the past 5 or 6 years, and what they plan to keep on doing as long as this administration's in power. And so, stopping a compromise would stop that. And I think that's what's going on right now to a certain degree.
So we see that, over the last couple of years, there was a Hamas government elected in Palestine in a clean, free election, and that this government was sanctioned by the administration, and either from the Israelis or from the Americans, there was no deals made, no talking with, no acknowledgement of this government. And then we see a similar situation happening in Lebanon now with Hezbollah. And we've also heard, and I wonder if you can say something about this, that the United States has pressured the Syrians not, or the Israelis not to talk to the Syrians over the Golan Heights and other outstanding issues between the two countries, because at the present time the United States is claiming that it doesn't want to reward the bad behavior of any of these so-called bad actors. Is this something that you've been?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think when we see time and again in Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon, even Egypt, is that the Americans are an agent of confrontation, not conciliation. And I think there's just no question about it at this point. And this is when we saw this generalized degradation in the rest of the region. This is very much symptomatic of this American policy toward confrontation, that one side can win and one side can lose. It's of course impossible. I think anybody that's spent time in the Middle East and understands Middle Eastern politics, you know that that's just, you can't eliminate these currents, very substantial currents, very historic currents of politics. You know, the Islamists, for instance, I mean, they're always going to be there. They're a feature of the landscape, but I think there still is a notion among, you know, with this administration that one side's going to win and one's going to lose.
They can be defeated.
Exactly.
Violently.
Violently. And I think we all know that the people that live there, that's not going to be the case. Yeah.